Good morning. This is Alon Rab, and we'll be speaking today with Dave Zirin about race, class, politics, and sports. Zirin's book, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, is published by Haymarket Books and takes its title from a famous quip by Muhammad Ali, one of the book's heroes. Zirin is a frequent contributor to many publications, radio and television shows, runs the excellent website, theedgeofsports.com. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you very much.
First of all, how did you come to sports writing? What's your background? Were you always a sports lover?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up an absolutely rabid sports fan in New York City throughout the 80s and 90s, and I was just obsessed with sports growing up. I played sports. I watched sports. My bedroom was a shrine to my favorite athletes, and sports writing came to be a very logical extension when I realized that I couldn't dunk a basketball and that there wasn't a big market for 5'10" centers in the NBA.
Even though there have been some good players in the NBA, everyone from Tiny Archibald to Spud Webb.
That's true. Those are point guards.
Right.
So I played down low for the feared French Seminary Quakers in New York City. So you could get away with having a 5'10" center in that league.
What are some of your earliest sports memories? Who were your heroes and why?
Well, it's interesting because now I write very much about the intersection of sports and politics. I mean, that's sort of my niche in sports writing. That's what interests me much more than just straight sports writing. And even as a young person, I gravitated towards athletes who had interesting, if not complicated, personal lives. Because to me, even at a young age, it made their on-the-field accomplishments all the more textured and interesting. So in the 1980s was really the, you know, if they call today in baseball the steroid era, in the 80s it was called the cocaine era in sports. And cocaine was, there were several scandals. It was found that the Pittsburgh Pirates mascot was actually a drug courier going from team to team when they would go on the road. It was a wild time. And I was very, very attracted to players who were known to have drug problems, were attempting to overcome them, were in and out of rehab, and would come onto the field as sort of like these damaged heroes. I mean, I'm thinking of specifically of people like the New York Mets players, Keith Hernandez, Darryl Strawberry, and Dwight Gooden. And the just incredible I've ever seen on a football field, but also someone who was very known, lived on the edge.
And being addicted to cocaine obviously hasn't stopped the president from advancing in his career.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah, as a youth, I followed soccer religiously, and some of my heroes were people like George Best of England.
Maradona as well.
Yeah, who combined a flamboyant lifestyle, brilliance in the field, and also some good politics sometimes.
And once again, Maradona as well.
Yeah. What is it about sports that you find important to the culture at large?
Well, that's a terrific question because, I mean, a lot of times I meet people, particularly people on the left, who try to make the argument that it has no importance, that it should be shunned the way a vegetarian would shun a Big Mac. You know, it should just be completely expelled from any sort of discussion. And I take very much the opposite tack on that. I mean, when I look at sports, in addition to seeing something that I think has the capacity of art to really express great beauty, great passion, the interaction between humanity, which is just can be something that's very inspiring. Sports is also something that's imbibed by roughly 200 million people in this country, at least, you know, in terms of playing or watching. So it's very much something that actually binds everybody in this country and to some degree binds everybody in the world. Yet too often sports is used as an absolute sounding board for the most right-wing ideas that our society has to offer, whether it's sort of dime-store patriotism and nationalism, whipping up support for the war in Iraq, sexism through the use of whether it's cheerleaders or scantily clad women to sell beer, and particularly one of the less discussed but more insidious thing that professional sports offers up to the American people is this idea of passivity, that there are people who play and people who watch. And if you're a watcher, you're never going to be a player. And that's such a ridiculously artificial separation, so at odds with the way sports has been practiced throughout the last, you know, 1,000 years of humanity. Mm-hmm. The very sort of modern idea that you have this separation. And because sports can be such a mouthpiece of these ideas, which I find, frankly, repellent, I feel like that sports can also be a place where those ideas are challenged, where we can actually raise issues about sexism, nationalism, war, or even the issue of passivity, and do we have to be just sort of passive participants in the process, and can speak to new audiences about these ideas.
I'm currently co-editing an anthology of global writings, fiction, poetry, creative nonfiction about soccer, and many of the pieces are about class, gender, inequality, and the uniqueness of each soccer culture. What do you feel distinguishes the American sports culture? I know it's a gigantic question, but...
No, it's actually not a gigantic question, because, and I'll tell you why, because American sports is so different from the way sports is practiced throughout the world that it actually becomes a sort of a narrow question, because it is so distinct. It's distinct in so many ways. I mean, it's distinct the way we call our national champions world champions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so rooted in these ideas of global conquest sports is in this country.
Mm-hmm.
It's rooted, I mean, American sports is the only sport where, you know, the only place where in every game you have to pay fealty to a flag before, for the privilege of watching a sports contest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the place where I think most directly, other than things like the World Cup or the Olympics, which are, I think, are exceptions,
mm-hmm.
that actually pit country against country in a very concrete and visible way, it's the only country that makes you sort of also get involved in sort of the bombast of the military, as if you're in Red Square before football games where they fly the planes overhead. Another thing is just the fact that we need scantily clad women in this country to tell us when and when not to cheer. I mean, something very unique to the sporting culture in this country. And lastly, one of the things that I'm still attempting to sort of get my head around is, like in the United States, is the absolute obsession with statistics and numbers.
Even
in a
though
way that's, I think, very unique to the rest of the world.
Even though I have to admit that I also fall prey to that and memorize whole teams, English soccer teams from the 60s and 70s and important goals.
Sure. But I think there's a difference between, like, important goals mm-hmm. and knowing what somebody bats against left-handed hitters on Tuesdays.
Uh-huh.
You know, it gets taken to a level that is beyond the pale.
So you feel that those aspects that you just described are a clear reflection of American society, the problems,
I do, and let me just be clear, though. I don't necessarily think the whole statistical thing is necessarily a problem. I mean, I think it's more of like an oddity, more than anything else, a distinguishing point, mm-hmm. that this idea of trying to quantify everything or understand it through numbers. I see that more as just sort of a reflection of the basic commodification that's so prevalent in U.S. society. But as far as the other things, like the nationalism and the sexism mm-hmm. and whatnot, I mean, I think that in some respects they're a reflection of the broader society, but I think it's actually more complicated than that. I think it's also something that sports is consciously used as a way to promote these ideas.
Your book is about the connections between radicalism and sports and how movements for social change and influence and also influenced by athletes.
Yes.
Who are some athletes that were socially and politically engaged that we should know about?
Well, I mean, in the book what I try to do, and it's up to the reader to decide whether I'm successful at this, but what I try to do is balance the giants of that category of athletes who reflected the politics of protest on the playing field with stories of far lesser known athletes who were significant in their day but have kind of been erased from history. Like, there are some athletes whose contributions in this regard were so gigantic that they'll never be erased. So instead, it's almost like their image and their legacy are managed to be as milquetoast as possible. You know, the way they put Malcolm X on a postage stamp and whatnot.
Or Jackie Robinson.
Well, that's the first one I was going to mention. Mm-hmm. Is like it's impossible to think of the post-World War II civil, early civil rights movement without thinking of Jackie Robinson. It's impossible to think of the black freedom struggle or the resistance to the war in Vietnam without thinking of Muhammad Ali. It's impossible to think of the women's liberation struggle without thinking of Billie Jean King or the fight for gay rights without Martina Navratilova and currently Cheryl Swoopes.
Mm-hmm.
So these are figures of tremendous significance, and I try to sort of restore their political teeth, like get the quotes back in their mouth, and people can see exactly what it is they stood for, ideas regarding anti-racism and anti-militarism, which are all too relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
And with the book as well, I try to speak about the stories of a whole host of athletes who perhaps an average sports fan or a, you know, just a casual sports fan would be less familiar with. People like the football player Dave Megacy, who left the National Football League in 1969 in protest of the Vietnam War and became a very conscious radical of his day. People like Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Lee Evans, the leading runners of the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, who attempted to organize the great boycott by African American athletes in the Olympics.
That's
the story I try to tell.
And one of the things I like about the book is that you show these athletes in all their complexity. So when you're talking about Jackie Robinson, you mention his courageous testimony against racism, but you also mention his connections to Nixon and
Yes. The
fact that he was, like all of us, you know, full of contradictions, full of high points, low
points.
Well,
that makes it interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's how we need to treat athletes and, you know, each other, not as cardboard spokespeople for one cause or another.
Exactly. And the story, actually, I love telling in the book the most, because it expresses all the contradictions of the era, is when Jackie Robinson testified against Paul Robeson at the House of Un-American Activities Committee meeting in 1949. And, of course, that's something I find repellent. You know,
mm-hmm.
I find HUAC and the whole era of McCarthyism repellent. I think Paul Robeson is one of the great human beings to ever breathe the air
mm-hmm.
on this planet. So, obviously, I oppose what Robinson did, but in looking at that story of what he did and when he did it, you actually get something that's much more defined by nuance and is actually really interesting. Like, you get a Jackie Robinson, if you actually read what he said to HUAC, and I include his speech in the book of what he said, he actually spends most of his speech not condemning Robeson, but condemning racism and saying things like, people in the South aren't riled up because some communist is telling them to be riled up. They're riled up because of Jim Crow, because of racism, because of the Klan, because of lynching. And one of the people on the HUAC panel, a Southern congressman, actually walked out during Robinson's statement because he was so offended. And then, of course, he spent one sentence bashing Robeson, and they used it as pretext to absolutely isolate and destroy Paul Robeson. And Jackie Robinson later called that his great regret. But it also speaks to that schism in the civil rights movement in the late 40s of people like Jackie Robinson and Thurgood Marshall, who believed that people influenced by socialist politics were actually a tremendous detriment to the civil rights movement and would hurt it. And then with Robinson, you see how he's assessing and reassessing that position over the course of his life. And just if I could say one more thing, if I could. I'm sorry to go on so long.
No, no.
But I also find the fact that he's like a Republican very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I'm not a Republican, but and I'm not a Democrat either. But what I find so interesting is the reason why he was a Republican was because his family grew up in Georgia, and it was the local Democrats, the Dixiecrats, who ran his family out of Georgia. And so in his mind, he always associated the Democratic Party with being the party of the South and the party of racism, and swore at a young age that he would never support him. Now, that's a part of the Democratic Party's history. I know they don't want us to know, but it can actually be told through telling the story of Jackie Robinson.
Hmm. On the cover is a photo of Muhammad Ali, and today he's known to some people, young people I meet, as a spokesman for several corporations. But what was his importance in the 60s and 70s, and what's his legacy?
I mean, his importance and legacy cannot be overstated. And it, once again, it's a legacy that has been largely swallowed up by the official writers of history. But Muhammad Ali was by far the most famous athlete in the United States. And he had one foot in the black freedom struggle and one foot in the anti-war movement. He was a draft resister before resisting the draft was fashionable. He was a critic of the integrationist politics of the civil rights movement before there was ever such a phrase as black power. And he was all of these things while being funny, poetical, and incredibly handsome. He was also somebody who let the world know that black was beautiful before that was a phrase anybody was familiar with. And so in this, in all of these regards, I mean, he's somebody profoundly important to his era. And he did all this as a young man with very little education, but somebody who was very brilliant in his way at being able to sort of absorb the pulse of his times.
Do you see a resurgence of politically outspoken and active athletes in the U.S. today? I mean, there are people like Steve Nash who came out against the war, Thomas, Foyle, athletes that you mentioned in the book. But are they part of a larger movement, or are they just some individuals here and there who are outspoken?
I think right now it would be an overstatement to say they're part of an overarching trend, and certainly it would be falsehood to say that they're connected and part of a cognizant, coherent movement.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that when you look at history, no movement starts fully formed. No movement starts with everybody having their ducks in a row and mm-hmm. their arms linked. It always starts with scattered individuals stepping up and making a statement and being loud about their beliefs. And you're starting to see that crack in the world of professional sports. And I think that's very important because sports, to a large degree, is a monolith apart from society. And its players usually come from very poor backgrounds but grow up to live in gated communities
mm-hmm.
very separate from the people who they grew up with. And so usually sports, and this was certainly true in the 60s, is usually the last monolith to crack. But when it does, it's actually a signal of a much broader trend in our society. And when you talk about people like Steve Nash, Etan Thomas, Carlos Delgado, Tony Smith, what you're beginning to see is the monolith crack. And that's something that, through my writing, I try to amplify that because back in Muhammad Ali's day, sports writers would absolutely excoriate athletes who dared to be political. Today, they actually try to kill them with silence.
I want to ask you about several recent events. The first is about Duke. Two African-American women reported being raped by members of the Duke University lacrosse team. In your article, Privilege Meets Protest at Duke, you offer an analysis. Could you explain a little bit to our listeners how you see that situation?
Well, sure, absolutely. I mean, while the truth of what occurred and as it's being sussed out through the whole legal process is still somewhat murky, there are things that certainly this entire episode has exposed for sure, without question and unequivocally. It's exposed the fact that Duke University is a cloistered school of tremendous privilege, largely populated by Northeastern students, in a small southern town of Durham of 185,000, where only the most slightly concealed tremendous resentment of both a class and race nature exists in the town. And the whole story as it came out, you know, two exotic dancers who both go to the predominantly black college, North Carolina Central, and they come to the Duke lacrosse team, which 46 of the 47 players are white. This lacrosse team on campus had an absolutely repellent reputation for all sorts of sordid misdeeds on campus. And to have the allegations come out on that, of that sort of milieu is something that just speaks terribly for the school and speaks terribly for the situation in the city right now. But one of the things I talk about in the article is that what it's unleashed has been really a tide of protests that recalls back to some of the best traditions in Durham, going back to the civil rights movement. And clearly, just looking at issues of poverty and segregation in Durham, it's a movement that needs to be rebuilt.
And it's encouraging to see how students and also people from the town and neighboring towns have come together to protest.
Right.
And
because certainly not everyone at Duke is evil. I mean, there are people at Duke who go there who hate the fact that their school is so isolated, who hate the fact that there's this town and gown split, as they say.
Yeah, college athletics is an interesting phenomenon. I teach at the University of Oregon, and the football coach, you know, earns about $1 million a year, and every year he complains that, you know, he's underpaid compared to USC coaches, and at the same time they're always talking about, you know, we don't have enough classrooms, we have to raise tuition. It's a very complicated issue. I wanted to ask you about Barry Bonds, baseball player Barry Bonds, who is closing on Babe Ruth's home run record and arousing much controversy and hate, receiving death threats. Do you feel this is about his reported steroid use, or is it all about race?
Well, I mean, I think it's almost like a perfect storm to some degree. I mean, it's a real mix of different issues that have all come together. What drives me nuts are writers who say that the whole controversy has nothing to do with race, which is just, to me, so willfully ignorant, you might as well work for Fox News if that's your position here. Of course, there's a racial component to this. As you mentioned, he's getting bags of hate mail. I think Major League Baseball is using him as a very convenient scapegoat to really much deflect all the criticism they're getting about the so-called juiced era of the 1990s and really dumping it on his shoulders. And there's something just absolutely repellent and disingenuous about that. And my position on this is that what this is really doing is deflecting from where the major league owners don't want the attention to go, and that's on their own complicity as actual suppliers of anabolics to players throughout the 1990s. And we can have debates about the actual destructive capacity of steroids, which is not something that's unequivocal, but certainly taking them in a black market way without a doctor's supervision is something that has the capacity to be very dangerous. Now, that being said, Bonds also has not made this easy on himself. I mean, he has a historical enmity with the media going back and forth. You know, that's an absolute fact. I mean, he's somebody who's never tried to sort of play the friendly rules, you know, in terms of playing nice. Okay, honey, I love you. Playing nice with the fans and whatnot. And, you know, he's attempted to do this his own way. And I think what it's exposed is that while perhaps the country in the United States has the capacity to accept an African-American superstar, you know, like a Tiger Woods or a Michael Jordan, it's patience for an angry black superstar. Still something that rubs far too many people the wrong way, and certainly there's a racial component to that.
I also read recently your article, A Day Without Pujols, or A Day Without Immigrants, baseball edition, about baseball and immigration. What are the contributions of Latino players to the game that many people here call the great American pastime?
Yeah, I mean, that's the first thing. I mean, the contribution of Latino players is so profound and so overarching that if we're going to call it the great American pastime, we really need to redefine what we mean by America. We better start at Punto Arenas or Tierra del Fuego and go all the way up to the tip of Saskatchewan there if we're going to call it the great American pastime. You know, I mean, I write this in the article, but 7 of the last 10 most valuable players in the American League are people who were not born in the United States, either Latin American or Ichiro Suzuki, who was born in Japan. And, you know, they've saved the game to a large degree. You know, I mean, players of Latino descent are superstars. They're Albert Pujols, they're Manny Ramirez, they're Pedro Martinez. And their contribution is so intense, but it's also the signal of a broader change. I mean, currently 36% of major league players are Latin American. A full one-third, almost one-third of players in the minor leagues are from the Dominican Republic alone, you know, a country that has a population slightly less than that of New York City. And, you know, some of this has to do with Major League Baseball officials trying to sign players on the cheap. of setting up baseball academies in Latin America. I mean, I say that not to denigrate the accomplishments of the Latin American ball player, but just to say that what this trend is illustrative of is about really the quest for profit and trying to train superstars without having to pay them.
There's a recent biography of Roberto Clemente.
Yes.
And it seems like he would fit perfectly in your book, mm-hmm. in your pantheon of heroes as a player who was very aware of the world and tried to make it a better world.
Yeah, I mean, I've written extensively about mm-hmm. Clemente, and it's not in the book because for the main reason is that my next book is going to be much more global mm-hmm. in its view, and I wanted to have a whole chapter about the impact of the Latin American ball player.
Mm-hmm. Could ask you many more questions, but I wanted to ask you two last questions. First, about Pat Tillman, a football player who decided to go and fight in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. And was later exploited, his legacy, his image by the White House. Could you explain a little about that?
Sure. I mean, I'll assume your listeners know the basics of the story, that he was an NFL All-Pro who had a $3.5 million contract on the table that he turned down to join the special forces and fight in Afghanistan after 9/11. He was somebody who was very private about his motivations for doing that. He turned down many offers from the State Department to become a recruiting tool to get more people to sign up for the war effort. And he was also someone, though, who we now know during his period overseas became very disillusioned with that effort. He had to do two, some say three, separate missions in Iraq. And when he was there, he told friends that he thought the war in Iraq was illegal and something that he really did disagree with. And eventually he was killed in an instance of so-called friendly fire, but it's an incident that's been subject to numerous investigations and now finally a criminal investigation because there's so many questions about the incident that have gone unanswered. And this isn't conspiracy theory stuff. I just want to say this to be very clear. This is something that his family has pushed for, and they're the ones who've really raised the questions. And his family is the reason why we even know about his opinions about Iraq or his opinions about Bush, for example, which were not very kind, because they were so upset with the government using him after he died as this kind of hero recruitment kind of figure, while at the same time not doing anything to get to the bottom of the truth of the circumstances of his death.
And his cynical use by the government is in line with similar uses. You could look back at Roman emperors, you could look at Mussolini, you could look at the Argentinian junta having the World Cup in 78 while they were, you know, killing thousands. And my last question, I understand you're working on a couple of books and a documentary film. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. I mean, one book I'm working on is a follow-up to What's My Name, Fool, that tries to look at this issue of sports and resistance from a much more global perspective, you know, and attempts to look at everything from racism in soccer to Latin American baseball players to the role that sports played in liberating apartheid South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things I try to work with there. I'm also doing a book called The Muhammad Ali Handbook that's meant to really look at the life of Muhammad Ali from a different perspective than mainstream history. And I'm signed to do a book called The People's History of Sports, just kind of this overarching book with the new press of Howard Zinn's People's History series. It's going to try to be like a People's History of the United States, except about sports. That's the one I'm the least confident that I'm going to finish in.
And you're working on a film with Barbara Coppola?
Yeah, with Cabin Creek Films. That's going to be based on What's My Name, Fool.
Well, those all sound like great projects. I hope you find time also to go and bounce a basketball a little bit or kick a soccer ball.
It's kind of scary. I realized the other day, just walking around my house, that I didn't have sneakers.
Oh, no, that's too bad.
And I ran out and quickly bought some for $14. But I honestly just could not believe it.
Well, as they say, the children of shoemakers walk around without shoes. And, you know, but thank you so
much. Busy sports writers walk around without sneakers.
Exactly. Hopefully the sneakers you got are not from a sweatshop factory.
No.
Okay, thank you so much, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
And that was Alon Robb interviewing sports writer Dave Zirin, author of What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States. Coming up next on the Thursday Morning Radio Zine, Andrew Geller speaks with Tom Lutz, author of Doing Nothing, A History of Loafers, Loungers, Slackers, and Bums in America. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard interviews Sam Gould of the Red 76 Collective. They do event-based projects that are rooted in art theory. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, hear reports on the arrests of lawmakers in the Gaza Strip, the ACLU's suit against the government to release records of surveillance, and a look at a new report on electronic voting. All that coming up this morning on the Thursday Morning Radio Zine for Thursday, June 9th. Stay tuned now for Andrew Geller with Tom Lutz.